The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt live inside the Beltway on a Victory Monday. The Cleveland Browns prevail over Tom Brady, of all people. He beat the Brady and the Bucks in the overtime yesterday, 23-17. Good mood here, even though Ohio State did manage to lose to the Michigan Wolverines. I'll have to talk about that in hour three, pursuant to my wager with one Larry O'Connor, who you see nightly on the Salem News Channel. Welcome to the Christmas season as well. We switched over to Christmas music. We've got the Christmas decorations up on the set. Christmas is official after, on the Monday after Thanksgiving. Genghis Kate, Vini Vidi Vici. She came, she beat me up, she saw, she just conquered everything, and then she departed. I posted a picture of her last night on my Twitter feed with her expression examining the ROI on naughty versus nice. I think she decided on naughty, but we had a wonderful weekend, a grand Thanksgiving. I hope you did as well. There is a lot of news this morning, primarily having to do with China. China is buckling under protests across the country. Shanghai rocked by protests as zero COVID anger spreads, according to the Financial Times. Also in the Financial Times, China rocked by protests as zero COVID anger spreads. It talks about Shanghai in this one after 10 people died in an apartment fire in Urumqi, where they were welded into their apartment complex because of zero COVID policy. New York Times picks up on that after a deadly blaze, a surge of defiance against China's COVID policies. The Telegraph has the same thing. Watch Chinese protesters call for Xi Jinping to resign as anti-lockdown marches sweep the nation. So we'll be watching on China today to see the secret police come out and remove everyone. It's the most unrest in that communist dictatorship since the Tiananmen Square protest of 1989. We know how that turned out, but they were all in one place, so the country was able to mobilize that kind of army response, and they probably can do the same at a variety of places around the country, but people have had it with their zero code. It doesn't work. And what China is worried about is that their vaccine, the homegrown China vaccine, doesn't do anything. And their healthcare system will be overwhelmed like ours was 2 years ago because they haven't used the right vaccine. They don't want to admit that theirs doesn't work. Lots to watch there. We'll come back to that. Twitter's $5 billion a year business has been hit by clashes with advertisers. Elon Musk takeover and return to the free speech arena has seen Carlsberg and GM and Volkswagen and others say they're not going to advertise on Twitter anymore, to which I say it's an interesting response by corporate management and C-suite virtue signaling to each other and other C-suites across the country, because it certainly doesn't help shareholders to take platform that are seen by millions of people around the world and take your brand off of it because you don't like Elon Musk. I really don't understand it. Very funny story in the Financial Times. Miami nightclubs mourn absence of high-rolling crypto entrepreneurs. The revenge of the nerds screeches to a halt after collapse in value of digital currencies. We cannot be broken. Ukraine's Vladimir Zelensky defiant on the anniversary of the Stalin famine. For those of you who don't know your history, Stalin tried to destroy Ukraine with a famine in the 30s. It did not succeed. Zelensky and the entire people of Ukraine celebrated their survival of that famine, which killed millions in the 30s, pointing out that even though they don't have an energy grid or a water supply over most of Kyiv, they will not bend, they will not break. Donald Trump in hot water for meeting with the known anti-Semite Nick Fuentes. I don't know much about Nick Fuentes. All I ever saw of him was a video of him harassing Ben Shapiro and his family. I assume because Ben was Jewish. I don't know, but I think that's it. I don't know if the former president has any advanced staff at all. If he does, they've got to be fired. And if he doesn't, he's got to ask himself whether or not he wants to continue to be seen with known anti-Semites and white supremacists. Nick Fuentes is not a Kanye sort of nuts person. Kanye, I wouldn't be seen with either, but or Ye, as he's called by Ye, as he's called by many people online. I wouldn't go to dinner with him either. But Nick Fuentes, really, Mr. President? You need a staff. You really do need a staff. You don't sit down with that guy. There's tumult in the European Union because the Joe Biden Inflation Reduction Act, which is actually a big spending bill, spends $369 billion to subsidize green energy, and the European Union doesn't like that because they've got green energy to sell along with a bridge in Brooklyn to you, and they don't want to be undercut. Meanwhile, in Great Britain, high taxes and no future sparks fear of a mass exodus of young Britons, sort of like California, where people are leaving California for Tennessee, or they're leaving California for Texas, or going to Arizona, or at least they were when Doug Ducey was going to be the governor for the next 4 years. I'm not sure under Katie Hobbs. They still have a Republican legislature there. They're going to Florida and Ron DeSantis. They're going wherever taxes are low. In Great Britain, they're just leaving the country, and that's a conservative government. They don't understand it, that Jeremy Hunt has condemned the Tories to a big loss in a couple of years at the polls because the Tories are supposed to be the lower taxes party, not the up the taxes party. I want to tell you, tomorrow's Giving Tuesday. I have to give too, and I'm looking forward to Semper Fi Fund, Fisher House Fund, and Gary Sinise Foundation. All three of those great veterans charities, and Larry O'Connor and I bet on the Michigan game, $100 per charity. So I've got to put my $300 in. Larry, I don't think, has $300. So he's got very lucky that Jackson Smith and Jigba couldn't play or Trevaeann Henderson couldn't play. But I think the Ohio State Buckeyes are still going to be in the Final Four. We just need USC to lose. That should be, come on, Utah. I haven't asked much of the Utes ever, but Utah's got to beat SC this weekend. Or whoever is playing the TCU, whatever they are, they got to take them out. Ohio State ranked fifth in the country. We need one of the other one-loss teams to lose so that we can go back and beat up on Michigan in round number two. If they get past either TCU, Ohio State will be ranked fourth. We'll have to beat Georgia. That'll be doable with Jackson Smith and Jigba and Trevaeann Henderson back in the lineup. But, you know, I'll give Larry his due. I have to talk about it in the 8 o'clock hour. Right now, though, before I talk about what I'm going to give in response to that, I want to remind you that Angel Tree is a great sponsor of our show. We have 28 days until Christmas. This is when Angel Tree gets busy to take care of the children of prisoners across the United States, 1.5 million of them. Listen to one dad talk about how important it is that Prison Fellowship's Angel Tree program connects him with his children. Play that, would you, Adam?
I got four little ones and then three older ones. But one of my little ones doesn't even know me. But this will be his first year getting something from me. And, you know, and I wished I was there to see his face. But, you know, I know he's going to accept it with love because he knows it's coming from me.
It is coming from him. And Angel Tree is coming from you. It costs $25 per connection between inmate and child. That gets them a Christmas present, a Bible, a note from mom or dad, or both if they're incarcerated. There's some of the 1.5 million children with a parent in prison whose both parents are. But Angel Tree's been up and running for 3 decades. It's a marvelous charity. $125 today will serve 5 children on Christmas Eve or the day before Christmas. 888-206-2764. You can call this morning. 888-206-2764. Or you can head over to the Angel Tree banner at hughhewitt.com. Also want to remind you, Alec is coming to town this week. So is Generalissimo. So I'm going to be able to see for myself if he's skinny Dwayne or not. Alec, the American Legislative Exchange Council, going to be in town inside the Beltway. And I am there. And Dwayne will be there, I think, on Wednesday and Thursday of this week. Or is it Thursday and Friday, Generalissimo? I think it's Wednesday and Thursday. Wednesday, Thursday. And you need to go to alec.org. Yep. The Rich State, Poor State handout is available at alec.org, American Legislative Exchange Council. They are coming here. We are going there. We are meeting up to talk about the ideas and the policies ahead, especially school choice. As that explodes across the United States, Alec coming to town, really looking forward to that. When we come back, we will check in with Generalissimo on how the diet did over the weekend. You know, a lot of scalloped potatoes, I hear, Dwayne was eating. We'll find out when we return on the next segment of this Inside the Beltway Monday edition. Ho, ho, ho. It's the Christmas season on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. First day of the Christmas season officially on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Hope you're enjoying our festive little bits of holly around the studio. And I would like you to know that Selena Zito's already been gone with the cookie table, I think. Good morning, Selena. Christmas is upon us. Is the cookie table underway?
Oh, yes. The grandchildren and I have already made several dozen cookies, and they ate probably more than half of them.
Now, I've got my nutcracker here. Do you have a nutcracker out?
I do.
Okay. Now, have you ever used the nutcracker?
I have.
You see, I've never actually used a nutcracker, so I was just curious whether or not it's a Yinzer thing, whether or not there are nuts available. So I'm glad to hear that. Let's go to the column I didn't get to talk to you about last week because I was off on Monday, your Chris Sununu column, and I want to go back to it. Where did you catch up with Chris Sununu?
The phone interviews that I did.
Oh, that's fine.
Yeah.
So it was by phone. And what did he say to you? Is he running for president?
Well, if you read the story, it kind of hedges on that. And I don't think it means this time, but I think that it's not something off the table for the future for Sununu. And I think that's really interesting because he's charismatic. He's run and won four times. Now a New Hampshire governor's term is only 2 years long. However, that's still four elections that you have to run in, and he's won, and he has governed as a conservative. He's not only run as a conservative, he has governed as a conservative and successfully in a state that is you know, very, very independent. If people don't know this, in the state of New Hampshire, more people are registered independent voters than they are Republican or Democrat. And so, you know, it's not an easy thing to just go ahead and win. You know, just walk out and say, yeah, I'm running again, you guys. He has to work pretty hard for that.
It would be interesting if he runs, the New Hampshire primary becomes secondary in importance, right? They used to say that when Mitt Romney ran, New Hampshire didn't matter, but it did. And that when anyone from a neighboring state runs, it doesn't matter, but it always does. But if Chris Sununu runs, I do think New Hampshire loses some of its luster, don't you?
Yeah, it would. It definitely would. But I don't think, I want to stress, I don't think that he would run this time. It's very similar. Do you remember when Tom Vilsack ran for for president as Democrat, moderate Democrat, from Pittsburgh, but was governor of Iowa. But then he dropped out before they even had the caucus, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, but I think Chris Sununu would have more staying power than Tom Vilsack. Yeah. Tom Vilsack's a nice guy, but I mean, he just didn't play on the national stage at all. And if we have these debates and we get going. Now, I'm wondering what is happening to the Pennsylvania Party after the blowout disaster of 2 weeks ago.
Oh, but it's really interesting. Well, I think you need to start at the most grassroots level. There are a lot of these, what they call themselves, Patriot Party. And these patriot sections of the party are running against regular county chairs. And a lot of them are very disruptive. They don't understand structure. They're very pro-Trump, but they're not very understanding of building grassroots operations, of raising money, of recruiting good candidates, because from the bottom up, it's important to do that. So you have that going on. But you also have some people that are going to run for the state chairman and try to rebuild the party. And I think that's really, really important because our state party for Republicans is terrible. So is our state party for the Democrats, by the way.
Do you know any of these would-be chairmen of PA?
Yeah, I do.
And what kind of age demo are we talking about? Because one of the things the party needs to do is get young.
Yeah, they range in age from mid-30s to 50, which I
think that's good.
That's good. Yeah. I think that's what you want.
And does Mastriano give up control over whatever he has? I mean, that was a disaster. Do people realize that was a disaster?
Yes. People realized that was a disaster, and he never had control of anything. So he just fades off into oblivion.
Okay.
I think the person you need to watch for in Pennsylvania, in the coming months is Dave McCormick. I think that he's going to come. I think he's going to come in early. I think he's going to run. I think he's going to have, I suppose, influence in the future of the party. And I think all those things are very, very good.
Going after Bob Casey Jr., just like we're waiting for someone to step up against Sherrod Brown, whether it's going to be Matt Dolan or Bernie Marino or both of them, the 2024 races have begun, and not just for president. Selena Zito, you have a great start to your advent. Get that calendar out. Get the nutcracker. I've got my nutcracker out, but our shot. We have to widen our shot for a little bit. Can we do that, Jacob? Widen the shot. Widen it even more. Pull back because I decorated the set, and no one can see the decoration. You can't pull the shot back. I guess not. We'll try and work on that during the break. I mean, I've gone to all this work to make the set wonderful, and it's not working. But I'll be back, and we'll keep trying right after.
Hey everyone, this is Dwayne Patterson, producer of The Hugh Hewitt Show. I've known for a while now that there's been far too much of me here in the studio, and I finally needed to do something about my weight. My excuse was always that I couldn't follow a plan with the crazy schedule that I keep. I heard about PhD Weight Loss and Nutrition and how they customize their program for each client, and I decided to call. This was no problem for Rachel and the PhD team. They had me map out what my day looks like and created a plan to follow. And so far, I've lost 16 pounds already, and I'm just 2 weeks in, on the way to my goal of losing 45. Call PhD Weight Loss and Nutrition at 864-644-1900 and make your appointment for your consultation. The plan is simple. It's based on science and nutrition. There's no pills or injections, and they even include 80% of your food if you want it. Call them right now at 864-644-1900 or find them online at myphdweightloss.com and tell them you heard about it from Dwayne, the producer Hugh actually has on The Hugh Hewitt Show.
Hi, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live inside the Beltway, joined by Jake Sherman. And you can read Punch Bowl AM every single morning. If you get the Jake Sherman newsletter, you can sign up for it for free. Good morning, Jake. Happy December almost to you. It's November the 28th. Did you have a good Thanksgiving?
I did. How about you, Hugh?
Wonderful. I had a three-year-old. Genghis Kate was here, so the house has been pillaged and looted. But other than that, we're fine. Jake, let's first talk about Nick Fuentes. Would you know Nick Fuentes? By the way, I've condemned the president meeting with him. I know about him because he's harassed Ben Shapiro for years. Anti-Semitic white supremacist nut who's 24 years old. Would you know him if you bumped into him on a train?
I would, yes, because I've seen him in media coverage in recent, in the last couple of years.
I might recognize him now. Before this, I've only seen him harassing Ben Shapiro in crosswalks and saying his vile, disgusting things. Do you think President Trump has any staff at all down there that vets whoever comes into Mar-a-Lago? It's a public restaurant, and I know Kanye is himself a menace to civil discourse. But do you think he would have known it was Nick Fuentes?
I have no idea. Ben Shapiro had an interesting tweet, which I thought was pretty apt, which was basically he said, and I'm not going to misquote him because I'm going to pull it up. He said a good way to not accidentally dine with a vile racist and anti-Semite you don't know is not to dine with a vile racist and anti-Semite you do know.
That's well put. And Kanye has gone there now and really flying the full freak flag on Jews, but Nick Fuentes has been there a long time. I'm just wondering, as a litmus test, whether or not people know who he is. They will now, but I just can't understand not having a team of people to vet the people who walk into Mar-a-Lago.
I'll say a few things here. Number one, that's probably true. Number two, we oftentimes have this discussion in politics, whether it's the staff or the lack of staff or whatever. At some point, Donald Trump is a grown-up. He was president of the United States. He's responsible for his own actions. And if he's meeting with somebody who's basically a neo-Nazi, at least one person, that's something he needs to take responsibility for. And I'm almost not interested in the discussion over staff or not staff. He's a grown-up who makes decisions. And if he's having dinner with a guy who's an anti-Semite, and by the way, I don't buy that he didn't know him. I don't buy it for a second. So I'll
that's interesting. Because I do, given how little the former president knows about the number of people in that orbit. And but it could have taken about 5 seconds to figure it out, right? You sit down with someone you don't know. It takes about 5 seconds to figure out you got a Holocaust denier, and then you stand up and leave. And you don't excuse yourself. You just leave, and you say, that's disgusting, and the table next door to you can hear it.
I agree with that. I agree with that. And
right, let's move to other news, because there's nothing more. Stupid move, bad move, apologize, move on, make sure you have better security and better information on both Kanye and other crazy people he's affiliated
with. Can I just add one more thing? I don't buy the fact that Secret Service is letting people who they don't know around a former president. I would say that as well. But anyway,
that's interesting.
Continue on.
Yeah, but I'm not going to blast the Secret Service because their job is not to staff. They just need to know if he has a weapon. You're allowed to meet with nuts. You just can't meet with a nut with a weapon.
Okay.
All right. Let's talk about the negotiations, which is part of Punch Bowl this morning. I don't think they're going to get a year full deal. I do think they could break out defense, because I know that the lack of assured funding cripples DOD's ability to do a lot of things. So I could see a DOD year appropriation and then a continuing resolution until next year so that Kevin McCarthy gets the gavel. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's possible. I think that will be that could be where they end up. Listen, this is a really bad situation for all involved. Democrats want a full year omnibus bill, which is understandable considering they're giving up the House of Representatives. Kevin McCarthy cannot be seen in any way supporting anything basically that Democrats do, because the conservatives in the conference want him to just punt government funding until January so they could have their own imprint on government spending. It's beyond idiotic. We shouldn't even spend much time thinking about it. It's so stupid, because putting a shutdown just a week into your majority is just unthinkably dumb. Listen, I am now becoming very bullish on the fact that this is going to be a late December. I think we're going to go right up into Christmas and maybe up into New Year's, depending on what the Democrats try to get done in this month. I think it's just going to be a very, very messy month.
There is no reason for the Republicans to do anything except a 1 month CR. And I hope they don't. Because to be the guy in charge of the House is a simple majority. You need both Leader McConnell and Leader Schumer in the room to do a deal, but you only need Kevin McCarthy come January. You don't need the Democrats. And I would not do anything other than maybe DOD for a year if they can plus it up. And that's the key. What do you hear on the China Select Committee, Jake? Because that is, to me, the most interesting part of this interregnum. McCarthy's pledged to it. Got to get stood up. Needs a chairman. Needs to get staff. They can't wait around. What do you hear?
I haven't heard much because for a few reasons. Number one, I think it's possible, if not likely, that Jim Banks will be the chair of that. I think that is a big consolation prize for losing out on the House majority whip race, which he lost to Tom Emmer of Minnesota. I think he's somebody who obviously has a keen interest in China and national security, and is a close ally of McCarthy. Now, I haven't heard much on the staffing up or the selection. There is the House Republicans will begin organizing pretty much their committees and everything in the next couple of weeks. So I think we'll get some more thoughts on that after next week, when the steering committee will meet to select chairs and committee assignments. So I think we'll get more definition in the next couple of weeks.
Now, you know, it's interesting about Congressman Banks. He would be a natural chair, as would Gallagher or Waltz or a couple of others. But I thought Jim Banks is running for Senate now. Haven't you heard that?
He, you know, that's going to be an interesting thing to keep an eye on. I've heard from people close to him that he was not interested in it. But now I think he'll have to consider it now that he is he did not win the leadership race. I will say this, though. There's no reason he can't do both. You know, there's no reason he can't chair the China Select Committee and run for Senate.
There is a reason. And that reason is, if it's that important of a committee, you need a sole focus purpose chair. I mean, you need someone to bear down on TikTok, bear down on Wuhan, bear down on their assault on Taiwan, bear down on their espionage in the United States. It's not a... If you're running for Senate in Indiana in 2 years, you got to be in Indiana every weekend. I mean, you got to be there 4 days a week, basically.
Yeah, but remember, everyone has to run. You don't have to be there 4 days a week. I mean, he's still a member of Congress. He's still going to have to be in the building, and they're still in the majority. So he's going to want to be he's going to want to be involved. And I would actually argue, if I were him, that this is helpful to him. It puts him center stage. It helps him on a very high profile issue. So I think he can do both. Whether he will do both, I don't know the answer to that, but I think he can do both.
All right, well, we will see. Now, tell me that you are certain, though, that there will be a China Select Committee, because I think I am.
Yes, positive. Yes.
So
positive.
That is going to what?
I mean, I don't know if McCarthy changes his mind, but he has said up, down, and sideways that he's going to do a China Select Committee. I mean, there's not been any. He's not left any doubt about that. So I have no reason to believe that it's not true.
And so the best thing to do, I think, is to get that set up and get the. They got to find. Chief counsel, they got to find chief staff. They all got to be Mandarin speakers. They've got to be serious about this, and they got to set up a hearing schedule and let everyone know what they're going to do and when they're going to do it. It's probably the most important thing on their plate. Now, Jake, tell me about the special in Georgia. Everyone can vote until Friday afternoon, Friday evening. The early voting is underway in Georgia. The election is a week from tomorrow. What do you hear, Jake?
There's been some chatter that Warnock was out on the trail. Raphael Warnock is the incumbent Democrat for the last couple of days in a very serious way. He's been all over the place. I think he held 6 rallies this weekend, and Herschel Walker has not held any. I don't know how this is going to go. I think Republicans are probably a little less motivated because they're going to be in the minority either way. But I don't have a good sense. I've not seen any great polling in the last couple of days. Nor do I think there will be polling. I don't know whether there will be high quality polling, but what do you think?
I think Herschel's in a pretty good slot, although there is no polling. There is no way to tell it out. However, Republicans have got the message that it does matter. 50-50 matters a great deal as opposed to 51-49 for a bunch of reasons having to do with the committee. And it's a 6-year job. Do the Democrats in Georgia want 2 senators in D.C., but does the state of Georgia really want not to have a voice in both caucuses? I don't know. I think it's a straight R.D. race. Straight R.D. I don't think it's got anything to do with the politics of Warnock or the personality of Herschel and Warnock. I think it's a straight R.D. vote. And I think Republicans are going to get out early and vote. We will see, Jake, by this time next week. We're within 24 hours of the last election in 2022. Go to Punchbowl News, subscribe, get your newsletter every morning. Going to be an interesting month in D.C. I'll be right back, America. It's the Monday edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show from live inside the Beltway. Hi, it's Hugh Hewitt, and listen up if you like to go on cruises. This year, we are back with Regent Seven Seas Cruises for an unrivaled experience with every luxury included. Join us for 14 glorious days on the Mediterranean, departing September 7th, 2023. We're excited to include special guest Guy Benson, senior politics editor at Town Hall and star of Fox News. Enjoy the sweet life with gourmet dining, unlimited fine wines, premium spirits, most shore excursions, and free unlimited Wi-Fi. Arrive in style with free business class airfare, starting in London and ending in magnificent Monte Carlo. Along with exclusive special events focused mostly on 2024, there's an exclusive private sale available only until November 30th. Don't wait. Book your cabin today. Call our friends at Frosch Studio City at 818-853-8536. That's 818-853-8536, or go to HughHewitt.com and click on the cruise banner for more information. That's 818-853-8536 or HughHewitt.com. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Josh Krasauer with Axios joins me. Josh, I want to get to Don Lemon berating Len Kordakovsky in a second. But first, what's going on in Georgia? What do you hear about the special? Early voting is underway in Georgia through Friday afternoon or evening. People can get out and vote early for Herschel or Raphael Warnock, and there will be a vote next Tuesday. What do you hear?
Yeah, well, early voting is quite healthy. Usually you see a drop-off in the post-general election phase of the election, but that's not the case this time around. I think given the November election results, given the turnout dynamic, you got to think Senator Warnock has a slight advantage. But look, runoffs are unpredictable. It really comes down to who shows up. And Governor Kemp, who won his governor's race, his reelection really handily, is spending a whole lot of political capital in trying to get Herschel Walker elected. So this is going to be a competitive race like all these Senate races have been lately in Georgia.
Yeah, I'm curious. Why do you think Warnock has an edge? Because I followed everything I can, and all I saw was one of the classic network, there are lots of Warnock signs out here. And, I mean, you can go to somewhere else to find a lot of Walkers. It's just not really – there's no data.
Yeah, so I think 2 reasons. Number one, I always like to look at the scoreboard in the general election, who came out on top, and Warnock led by about a point. You got about 2 points for the Libertarian candidate. But, you know, there is a number. The other factor is there is a number of folks, as we saw in the November election, that voted for Governor Kemp enthusiastically but couldn't punch the ballot for Herschel Walker. So I know Kemp is trying to really do yeoman's work in trying to get his voters to come out for Herschel. But there are a lot of suburban voters around the Atlanta area that have been split ticket voters in the last couple of years. And it's going to be difficult, I think, for Walker to get to 50 just because of that suburban Atlanta resistance, frankly, to you know, some of the baggage that Walker brings to the table.
Now, I think it's a pure RD election, Josh, meaning that there's no reason for Democrats to go out because they've got the Senate. There is a reason for Republicans to go out because a 50-50 Senate is better than a 49-51 Senate on the committees. And so the pure R's and the pure D's may or may not show up. I just don't know that there's any data. I don't think I've seen any. Have you seen any data on early voting favoring Warnock?
And all I've seen is that the early voting numbers are similar to the turnout levels as we saw in the November election. So people, we don't know who exactly is showing up, but we know people in both parts of the state, in the more Democratic parts and in the more Republican parts of the state, are showing up in pretty healthy numbers. But yeah, I mean, this is Georgia. Georgia is the new bellwether state politically, and it's going to come down to, as we learned in November, persuadable voters that make up the critical mass of and make up that will make up the winning candidate's majority. These are the voters that may not be, you know, numerous in number, but, you know, make up 5 to 10% of the electorate. They go back and forth between the parties, and ultimately they're going to decide this one.
And they got to get out. And this is what is going to be interesting to me. Is turnout might be the same early voting, but what happens on Tuesday is going to be the key here. Now, Josh, I've denounced the president meeting with Fuentes. I would know Fuentes only from the Shapiro videos where he's harassing my friend Ben Shapiro. Clearly an anti-Semite, 24 years old. He's a nut. I don't think he should be in Mar-a-Lago. I don't think the president should be eating with Kanye anyway. But I just played 7 minutes of Don Lemon berating Len Khodorkovsky about this. I mean, are we ever going to break away from 24/7 Trump on CNN? Isn't Chris Licht trying to get away from that?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because they didn't lead with that story. It was later on in the morning. But you know, like this is one of those stories that's going to be interesting to see how all the networks cover how much airtime, how much oxygen Trump gets. I mean, it is a big issue. A former president dining at his personal club with one of the more vile neo-Nazis and anti-Semites out there on social media, right?
Yes.
But you also don't want to give this guy any more attention than he deserves, right? So, I mean, there's also the Kanye West factor. What does he do? Like, why? I mean, he's also someone who's made pretty anti-Semitic and vile statements himself. So, I mean, why Trump is like allowing these people into his club, why I think Milo Yiannopoulos was also, I mean, these are some of the most disreputable people that you can find politically. And, you know, there's a Trump issue, and I'm surprised that more people aren't following Chris Christie's lead and just in the Republican Party and just condemning Trump himself, because it does seem like he's politically wounded. And there's an opportunity for Republicans to move on from
the you know, the oldest rule in politics, for those who might run against him, when your opponent is busy destroying himself, don't do anything. So I think there's a lot of that. And Governor Christie, of course, wants to be known to be in the ring. But I am more interested in the coverage of it at this point, because what else can you say other than that was really dumb? Don't ever do that again. This guy's a bad guy. So is Kanye, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know anything about Kanye. I didn't even know he was called Ye until this weekend. But I just think the obsessive, it just is it's a show that Trump still has a grip on Don Lemon's mind. And Don Lemon is most comfortable when he's denouncing Trump. And I wonder if most of the media is in the same place. And America, I think Americans turn it off. They get the message. Oh, he met with it. That was stupid. That was bad. That was very bad. What next? But CNN is stuck on it. I thought they were moving away from that.
Well, you know, I think there's a bigger, I mean, there's the Trump angle, but there's also the House leadership or the McCarthy vote angle, where you have two Republicans who spoke at this Fuentes conference. Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar, they're now power players of a sort in the House, as Kevin McCarthy tries to get a majority. But this is not an issue that's insignificant.
Oh, no, it's not. But It's also not, it's just about rebranding CNN, which I was trying to get to. If you're trying to rebrand and not all Trump all the time, then you don't leave with Don Lemon berating someone for 7 minutes over something he has no control over. I, however, have control over having Josh Groschauer back. He'll be back next week and do it every Monday. Axios.com for all your Josh Groschauer news. Stay tuned, America. I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. What race are you? Do you have any idea what race you are? How the United States government would classify you? Professor David Bernstein is at the George Mason University Scalia School of Law. He's got this great new book out, Classified, The Untold Story of Racial Classification in America, which I read this weekend. David Bernstein, welcome, Professor. Great to have you on.
Thanks for having me. Great to see you.
I think we've got to begin with Directive 15. Now, I have actually taught the affirmative action cases forever, and I didn't know about Directive 15. So it doesn't matter how long you've been teaching the affirmative action cases for or what your opinion on the Harvard case is. If you don't know anything about Directive 15, you're going to not understand the path we went off on. Would you explain to people what it sounds so Orwellian, what Directive 15 is?
Sure. Don't feel bad about it. I've been teaching the same cases for years, and until I researched Classified, I had no idea about it either. It's really pretty obscure, but extremely important. So back in the 1970s, we had all these civil rights laws that were passed in the 60s and all these great society programs that were enacted in the 60s. And the government wanted to track civil rights statistics to make sure people weren't discriminating for voting and education and employment. And they wanted to see if the great society programs were working. So they started collecting data about all this stuff, but the problem was there was no official classifications to know who was black and who was white and who was whatever. So they got a committee together. It was not very well publicized, not very controversial. It was just to regularize the statistics keeping. For example, they wanted to track people of Spanish language heritage who are mostly Mexican American, but different agencies were using different definitions. Some were only tracking Mexicans. Some were tracking Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, and Cubans. Some added an other category. Some called them Latinos. Some called them Spanish-speaking households. Some called them Spanish surname. So they were getting data that was not consistent. It was apples and oranges. And you know what? We need to make some official definitions, figure out what the official racial categories are in the U.S., and they came up with five: African-American, white, Asian-American, Native-American, and Hispanic, which was how they now call Spanish language heritage. But they said Hispanic is officially an ethnicity and not a race.
Now, David, what happens then is that's 19 in the 70s. 20 years later, I mean, more than 25 years later, we're jumping almost to the end of the book, page 158. In 1999, HHS recommends that any statistical work within HHS's purview, meaning all of the drug studies that FDA does, are going to use the Directive 15 categories. And I thought to myself, huh? These categories don't make any sense for medical research, do they?
They don't. And Congress said, we want you to make sure you're including people of different backgrounds in your studies to make sure you're scientifically valid across different areas. And they didn't really think about it much. But they just told HHS, you need to figure out how to do this. And HHS could have convened, experts, sociologists, anthropologists, geneticists, and so forth, and figured out, okay, what groups make sense, both from a genetic basis and also people have different sociological criteria that may affect how studies work. But that would, of course, been extremely controversial to have the government go out and, in a very public way, define what groups are important for medical research. So HHS took the path of least resistance and just took these classifications, which, again, were only created for statistical purposes. And not only that, they officially said when they published this rule in 1977, this is not to be considered a scientific rule. It's not considered to be used for any purposes other than statistics keeping. They nevertheless just sort of naively brought in these statistics, these categories that don't make any sense. So if you see there's been a study done on Asian and on that a particular drug works the following way on Asians, you have no idea whether they mean people from India, people from China, people from the Philippines. It could be any or all of those. Hispanics could be people who are of Spanish descent, could be people of indigenous descent, could be people of mixed descent, could be people of 100% African descent. You don't actually have any idea of what the genetic basis for these classifications is when they do these studies. And yet, for example, Moderna had to delay its vaccine because it didn't have, quote-unquote, enough Hispanics, and the National Institutes of Health said, we're not going to approve your vaccine unless you delay it and get more Hispanics in your study.
Professor Bernstein, again, the book is classified. I really recommend it to anyone who's tangling with the issue of affirmative action. And even beyond that, how government works. This is actually a perfect example of the original sin being compounded and pathway evolution go along to get along with the classifications that came out 50 years ago, and they make no sense. And the Asian American classification, I think, David, after reading your book, that's the most absurd one, isn't it? I mean, Asian American, it's just so idiotic to use that term.
Yeah, so in fairness to the bookkeepers back in the 70s, at the time, people from Asia with origins in Asia were less than 1% of the U.S. population. So they felt like they didn't have enough people to break it down. And at the time, we basically just had Japanese, Chinese, and Filipinos, and they were doing pretty well economically, so no one was all that concerned. But it turns out that since then, we've had a massive amount of immigration from all over Asia. It's over 60% of the world's population. And, of course, people have very different cultures, appearances, languages, religions, food, everything you can imagine. There's nothing in common between someone from Pakistan and someone from Vietnam and someone from the Philippines. But they're all stuck into this one classification as if there is some commonality, which makes really, like you said, no sense at all.
No sense at all. And pathway evolution is a theory by which you can't back up. You have to keep going forward on whatever road you took unless you turn around. Is there any chance that classified, your new book, will prompt them to maybe tear up Directive 15 and start over? Because there's obviously a good reason to understand the medical implications of ethnicity. And there will be, I always use the example of sickle cell anemia, right? It's predominantly an African-American concern in the United States. But it's a genetic concern. There is a reason to track ethnicity, but there's not a reason for this absurd classification system.
Yeah, I think in the medical context, if you read the medical literature 20 years ago, which I did, people felt, you know, maybe we could use these racial classifications as really crude proxies for genetics right now, but surely 20 years from now we'll have cheap and available genetic tests and we'll just rely on people's genetic backgrounds, which are a lot more indicative of their health risks and, of course, don't track with these racial categories. I'm an Ashkenazi Jew. We have a lot of interesting genetic anomalies because we were a very small population that grew very quickly and had almost entirely in marriage, but no one tracks us under these categories. We're just considered white. So they thought that would happen, but because of these classifications and the factors you mentioned that it just becomes path dependence, they just stuck with them, and we have very little genetic research compared to what we should have. It's really crowded out much better medical research, and you know the only hope we have is that courts or whatnot will intervene and say, wait a second, well, you know, this doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense when Harvard is using race for diversity to say that someone makes the same contribution for diversity regardless of whether their parents came from Spain or Argentina or Mexico or Guatemala and what actual race they are. Does it make any sense to put someone from India in the same diversity classification as someone whose parents came from Taiwan? Does it make sense, for that matter, to put someone whose parents came from Iceland in the same classification as someone whose parents came from Turkey, but they're both considered just white under these classifications?
You know, David, I was surprised to learn we have no category for Arab. None. Now, maybe it would be a Semitic category, but I didn't know until I read Classified that Arabs are white under the government's view. And it just seems to me there's got to be a sufficient ethnic differential in the genetic makeup that for medical research, at least, you would want to differentiate Arabs from Northern Europeans. I mean, isn't that an obvious? There's got to be a genetic difference there.
Yeah, and my understanding, I'm not a geneticist, but my understanding from reading the literature is you can actually break up the European North African and Middle Eastern classification to 8 different genetic classifications, basically. Of course, there are then subgroups within them. And that, you know, even groups that we think of as being very distinct, like Africans, it turns out that Africans have a tremendous amount of genetic diversity within them, and that some of the groups of in Northern Africa that we think of as black, like Somalis and Ethiopians, are actually more closely related to Arabs and Jews than they are to sub-Saharan Africans. So it really becomes a huge mess. And of course, the African-American population in the United States has very large admixtures of European and Native American, and a lot of Americans, for that matter, have some African ancestry from ancestors who melded in eventually to the white population. So it really becomes entirely ridiculous to start making medical decisions based on someone's purported race.
I am hoping the classified gets more than a footnote in the coming Supreme Court decision on affirmative action. But you know what the Chief Justice says is that we have to move beyond this sordid business of classification on race, his famous quote being the way to end racial discrimination is to end discriminating on the basis of race. The first step would be to dump these classifications, David. Has anyone suggested that obvious but radical step?
Well, I sort of suggested in the book in the sense that I say that we should have separation of race and state for many of the same reasons we have separation of church and state, right? We understand that historically speaking, there were horrible wars and conflicts over who gets to control the government based on their religion in Europe and so forth. A 30 years war killed like a third of the population of Central Europe. So for similar reasons, we know race is an extremely dangerous, volatile subject that leads people to organize themselves on that basis and try to get stuff for themselves against other people. So the problem is really that you can't completely abolish these classifications as long as you have civil rights laws that depend on knowing who's being allowed to vote and so forth and so on. So, you know, the scope of my book isn't long enough to talk about whether we should go that far. That's a much more controversial area. But I do say that we should at least have a strong, number one, a strong presumption against classification. Maybe we should even have a test that we use for individual classifications called the compelling interest test. Maybe the government should have to show a compelling interest before it classifies us at all. And then once it does classify people, it has to be narrowly tailored to achieve the actual result. If you're trying to achieve medical research gains, you can't classify people as Hispanic or Asian or white in these broad, crazy classifications. If you're trying to achieve a diversity, you can't say that someone, Julio Iglesias' son, is diverse in the same way as someone who grew up in an indigenous village in rural Mexico. So those are my two big proposals.
David, and you make the case simply by taking us into the thicket of it. It's fascinating. It's kind of appalling, actually. Aren't you kind of appalled that we're so deeply stuck in this last minute to you on Classified, the untold story of racial classification? Are you appalled? I mean, I can't believe we're here.
Yeah, I was really pretty shocked. I didn't even know we had official classifications, frankly, until I did this. And then I found out, for example, I have a whole chapter on Native American identity.
Yes.
The whole world to itself. The Bureau of Indian Affairs will actually issue people a certificate of Indian blood quantum, saying whether you're 1/4 or 1/2, as if you're in Nazi Germany and you're Michelining or whatever, or those other phrases they use. I was pretty, and the medical thing is just completely, I mean, I don't like making Nazi comparisons, but it gets to some sort of Mengele level where we're trying to discern people's medical and scientific history based solely on how they look.
It is a complete labyrinth. It makes no sense, and it ought to be abandoned. And Directive 15 is where they should begin. But first, people need to know about it. And David Bernstein, thank you for being the guy to do that. The book is Classified, The Untold Story of Racial Classification in America. It's available today. Go to Amazon.com. Randy Barnett told me I had to read this, and I always do what Randy tells me to do. And I read it, and I said, wow, I had no idea. Congratulations, Professor Bernstein. That is it's a terrific book at a timely time. And I believe it's going to show up in the Supreme Court's opinion and the Harvard case. I think. I hope.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.